Can you predict what will come in 100 years? Or in 10? Or in the next minute? Some people think they can. They'll predict the shape of the future because they make the future. Because they see beyond the known dimensions of time and space into the unknown, Dimension X. We go ahead now in time.
Cosmic ray bomb they're testing out in the Pacific tonight.
A sparkling crystal diamond, vibrating at a higher frequency so y'all don't have to bother none.
Long run, our ship will make the CR bomb back page stuck.
Come take a listen.
Half the principles in this ship are pure theory.
Let your sensorium be nourished as Matt sheds light on the millennial ecstatics of the day.
So keep your mic open and keep talking. If anything goes wrong, we want to know exactly why.
Okay, welcome everyone to the Matt Vaughn Show, and I'm here with Scott Mortensen, a jazz aficionado, the author of Jazz in the 70s, .blogspot.com. Today we're going to learn about jazz. And to start off, Scott, what is jazz, man?
Wow, that is a big question. Books have been written about jazz, figuring out what it is and what it means. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but basically, if you sort of look at it from the historical perspective, it started off in the early 1900s in New Orleans. It's sort of a hybrid music because you had the influence of the Caribbean and Latin worlds, you had Africa, you had the United States, and all of them coming together. And then you throw in a genius out of left field, Louis Armstrong. And then it really expanded from there. I mean, you think about the great migration of African Americans from the South all over the United States, West Coast, up into Chicago, Northeast, Boston, New York. And really, they carried the music with them, and it's like I said, a hybrid music. It's sort of, people have described jazz as African rhythms combined with European harmonies. But the biggest thing to me when I think of jazz, I think of improvisation, and I think of freedom. It's sort of a one of the most wonderful things about jazz is it can be almost anything you want it to be. The only rule is there are no rules.
Sounds good to me. Okay. It sounds good to me. Although maybe that's a little intimidating. No rules. So maybe that's why one reason why jazz is hard to... Because one thing I want to get into today is the impenetrable nature of jazz. Sure. And I was talking to you about this before, that jazz is one of those things where it's like you want to say you like it, but you don't really know what it is.
Sure.
Or you might even say you don't like it when you don't really know what it is. Is this fair to say about jazz?
Well, I think
it's impenetrable.
Well, I think it can be intimidating to people. You know, years ago, jazz was popular music. So it would be like, you know, you hear Taylor Swift on the radio, or whoever on the radio today. And years ago, you'd hear Duke Ellington, or you'd hear Louis Armstrong, or you'd hear, you know, the big band leaders of the day. They were popular musicians. So there was no, you know, jazz was just part of popular culture. But what I think has happened over, let's say, the last 50 years or so is jazz has sort of moved a little bit. Well, jazz isn't part of pop culture anymore in the way that it used to be. So you kind of have to do a little bit of digging. But jazz is not if I were speaking to someone who didn't know anything about jazz, I would say it's not brainiac music. It's don't be intimidated by it. It's just like going to a movie or picking up a book and reading it, and it's all about enjoyment and sort of diving in and splashing around and seeing what you find.
And for the for our many listeners who are maybe not jazz fans, I really want to point out that Scott's blog is a good place to start, because obviously jazz is such a huge musical genre. Where do you start? And I think this is a good place to start.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's focused on jazz in the 70s. There's a lot of music that was very popular, like I said, in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And when people talk about jazz, a lot of times, and you really saw this in the Ken Burns jazz documentary, he spent a lot of time talking about jazz from its beginnings up until about 1970, the end of the 60s. And I can understand that, because Ken Burns was talking about jazz as a cultural force. But just because it wasn't or it hasn't been as popular doesn't mean there isn't a lot of great jazz being made today. It's sort of, like I said, a little bit off to the side. They're not going to sell as many records, but there's still, from the 70s to the present, all sorts of great stuff happening.
Wait, so Ken Burns' famous documentary stopped in the 70s?
Well, he kind of threw a bone to, from, like, the really, he ended on Louis Armstrong's big hit, Hello Dolly, which is about, like, 1971 or so.
Oh, interesting.
But it's hard to tell a coherent story about jazz starting in the 70s because it's so many different things. Okay. I mean, you could even argue that there is no one jazz. There's jazzes, or there's different, it's like Venn diagrams or circles, you know, that are kind of like many, many, many different sort of sub-types of jazz. But again, if you're a beginner, don't be concerned about that thing. It's just like turning on the radio when you're a kid and hearing different songs, and you're drawn to some songs and you're not drawn to others. Jazz is no different. Just dive in the pool, swim around. If you hear something you like, follow on that.
Also, though, I am looking forward to learning more about jazz so I can lord that over people.
Drop some serious jazz knowledge.
Yeah. So let's go with that for a second. So you said Louis Armstrong is the guy who kicked it all off?
Well,
you
said Louis
Armstrong?
Louis Armstrong.
Is that the same guy?
Same guy. Actually, he said, he was a black man, and he said, I'm not Creole, so don't call me Louis. So he actually preferred Louis. Armstrong was not the first jazz musician, but you could argue, and people have argued, that Armstrong was the first great improvisational genius of jazz. In other words, he took something that was kind of like a folk music, and he elevated it and in some ways made it an art, or in some ways changed it fundamentally.
I see. Wow.
So
I'm learning.
He's an improviser.
So is Louis Armstrong the Bill Monroe of bluegrass?
That is a great analogy. Yes. Just like Bill Monroe is the father of bluegrass, you could argue that from an improviser musician point of view, Louis Armstrong is the father of
jazz. I do want to take a time out here and point out to people that Scott just pointed out that was a great analogy. I mean, just saying.
And bluegrass, I would say, is bluegrass is country jazz. You know, if jazz is in its origins African American, bluegrass. I love bluegrass too, by the way. It's a lot of that music has overlap, and then also, you know, it's instrumental oriented, and it's virtuosic music, and it's so yeah, that's a perfect example.
Okay, so yeah, well, let's explain. So, would you like to do the honors of what Bill Monroe did for bluegrass?
You say.
Oh, thank you. I happen to know. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Bill Monroe, from what I've read, he is the one who took old-timey music
Yes.
and added a more modern style of banjo playing to old-timey music, and that's what we know as bluegrass today. Before Bill Monroe, it was old-timey. I like old-timey music. For the listener, old-timey, in my estimation, sounds more like Irish folk music.
Well, that, and that's what it was. I mean, I think the people that had came and settled in Appalachia and in the, mostly in the southern states, in the United States, carried the Anglo-Irish traditions with them. And so a lot of that stuff, you know, the folk music of the South and the Appalachian Mountains, is it's the same music. You hear it in the United Kingdom today, even. So... taking it back to jazz, it is very much the same sort of thing, because even to this day, when you think about jazz, you got to think about it, or you don't have to, but I think it's helpful to think about it as it is still on some level folk music, less than it used to be. But it's also an art music, and it's also commercial music. I mean, these are people who are trying to make a living. So again, people sometimes think of it as very brainy and sort of apart. Something you'd see in a museum.
Right,
it's,
right.
It's not. It's, I mean, the best jazz is, you know, it hits you in the gut. Just like any great music is going to, it makes you feel something. And I think jazz is great at making people, it can express so much and it can make you feel so much. That's why it's one of the reasons I love it.
Well, let's go back to that it's not a popular art form now. Like it was, so in the 40s and 50s, it was a popular art form. It was, is it fair to say that was the rock and roll of the time?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about people like, again, you get back to Louis Armstrong, you look at Duke Ellington, you look at Earl Hines, most of these guys had big bands. Big bands were the dominant sort of...
Okay, so big bands is jazz.
Big band can be jazz. It doesn't have to be jazz.
Okay.
There were big bands that there was no improvisation. They're often called suite bands. They may be dance bands where everything is written out ahead of time. But a jazz big band, there's going to be improvisation. There's going to be an opportunity for soloists to stretch out.
Okay. So what was Ricky Ricardo doing?
Well, that's Latin music. Well, that's another whole thing. Is that one thing we haven't talked about at all? And one thing that is something that I've actually been spending a lot of time exploring lately is Latin music and its relationship to jazz. Because there's Latin music that is not jazz, and then there's also Latin jazz. There's Latin musicians who have consciously emulated jazz musicians, and again, you start getting this sort of overlap. So musicians like Tito Puente, Eddie Palmieri, Ray Barreto, a lot of these guys are either Cuban or Puerto Rican that were very instrumental in sort of taking Latin music and moving it in the direction of jazz. In other words, adding the element of improvisation, adding the element of, well, the Latin music has a jam session, and the term is descarga. It's again, very Latin music is part of the jazz equation from the start, because again, you think about New Orleans is right there at the bottom of the United States, closest to the Caribbean, close to, the Spanish speaking part of the world. And, it's always been part of it, but I'm not sure Ricky Ricardo would be jazz, though.
To get back to it. Yeah. Maybe Lucy was jazz, though. Am I right?
Jazzy.
Well, that's a whole nother story. Okay, so big bands, when that was popular, the jazz was the main thing. That was the rock and roll of the time.
Right.
And jazz lost, you were saying earlier, jazz lost prominence when rock and roll came in. Yeah, so jazz got kicked to the side? Is that...
Jazz became less popular. Jazz became... Well, that's what our parents used to listen to. I don't want to listen to what my parents... And you had... I mean, Elvis is... the development of rock and roll is so much more than Elvis. But Elvis was, of course, the great sort of... when people think about the beginnings of rock and roll as a mass phenomenon, you got to think of Elvis. And so with Elvis, and then continue on to especially bands like the Beatles and this sort of whole English invasion, you really kind of saw jazz being pushed to the side. And part of that had to do with, you know, changing demographics, you know. And it's, you know, it's hard for any popular music to stay popular forever. I mean, Jacob, my son, listens to rock. He loves Hendrix and he loves, but his friends often say, well, why are you listening to that dad rock? You know, there's, you know, it's kind of, right. So I think that rock and roll right now for a lot of young people represents the past and something that's a little bit passe. Right, and I think that jazz kind of, that happened to jazz as well.
Right, very good point, very good point. Yeah, Poison is not dangerous. It's, yeah, your parents go for nostalgia to see the Poison concert.
Okay. Exactly, exactly.
Okay, okay.
Right. All right, Pat Benatar is an oldies show now.
Right, right, right. I feel like we're getting somewhere here. I feel like we are penetrating the impenetrable here. And that's what this show's all about, really.
All right.
Do want to remind everyone, remember I had that good point earlier about Bill Monroe,
Father Bluegrass.
I will keep saying about that. I will. I'm very proud of myself on that. Okay, so here we go. We have rock and roll takes out jazz. It's the parents. It's the music of the parents. Now, we were talking earlier about how jazz was not incorporated by the flower power 60s zeitgeist. Can you say some more on that? That was an interesting thread.
Yeah, I think well jazz, you know, the whole flower power 60s things, you think about Woodstock. I mean, there was no jazz at Woodstock. That was all, you know, folk music and rock you know, that was the music of young people of the day. Now, that doesn't mean that there wasn't some fantastic music being made at that time. There most definitely was. But I think that, I think, again, the way that I, people in the universities and when I was studying English back in the day, they would use the term marginalization. Things are being pushed to the margins. They're not in the mainstream. They're sort of pushed off to the side. And I think that's kind of what happened to jazz, and in some ways, that's where it still is. It's there, and it's very vital, and it's thriving in some ways. But you're not going to hear jazz on the radio unless it's public radio. You're not going to find jazz on major labels. You're not going to find jazz on the Sony of the world, or what used to be Columbia and RCA. Labels, they've all been consolidated now, but it's all being produced by people who have a passion for it, you know, and a lot of the best labels in the world for jazz are run by one or two guys that just have a passion for it, and they care about it, and it's kind of semi-underground, I guess you could say.
Well, one thing you were saying earlier about why it wasn't incorporated into the 60s flower power zeitgeist is that jazz is more about the elder, respecting the elder statesman who is very skilled.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Jazz one part of jazz that can be both good and bad is that the jazz musicians are very aware of tradition. And, you know, there is... The way that jazz worked for a lot of its history was, you know, the young guy comes along and sort of sits at the feet of the older guy who's experienced. They would often join big bands. They would learn the ropes. It was sort of a master and apprentice sort of thing. And that whole idea, if your mantra is don't trust anyone over 30, that doesn't really work. It doesn't go together. So, now when I say all that about tradition, you've also got to, or should also realize, or from one of the great things about the jazz tradition is part of the tradition is don't be be a slave to the tradition. Part of jazz is that it reinvents itself. It's changing all the time. You know, I could play you a record that might sound like, you know, it's all electronic instruments, or I could play you a record that is, you know, Louis Armstrong from 1927. They're both jazz. It's just evolved. It's changing all the time.
Got you. Okay, Muhammad Ali was... What was Muhammad Ali?
Well, I was just making a comparison between Armstrong and Muhammad Ali, because when I was a young person, I know I'm older than you, but when I was a young person, if Muhammad Ali was fighting, having a boxing match, it was a big event. My father was a big boxing fan. Usually a lot of people would come over our house, and Ali was bigger than life. He was sort of a cross generation, cross races, cross... I mean, he was a worldwide figure, and I think Ali was... people have argued that Ali was like the most recognized human being on Earth, because people in Africa loved him and knew him, and Louis Armstrong really was the Muhammad Ali of his day. I mean, he went to Africa, and hundreds of thousands of people showed up. It was like Woodstock-sized crowds would show up to see Louis Armstrong. And he was in movies, he was in, you know, he'd be on television. People don't understand that he was a giant media figure.
I see.
And it wasn't just music. He was a celebrity and like I said, one of the most well-recognized people on the face of the planet, which seems strange because we think of him as a sort of if you're a jazz fan, you think of him as a hero. But I think a lot of people, you know the name Louis Armstrong, but you don't really know that much about him necessarily.
Right, and I just know the big cheeks.
The big cheeks. Well, that's Dizzy Gillespie, actually.
What?
Dizzy Gillespie was the one that had the big cheeks that expanded way out.
Oh, see, wait a second.
Well, Dizzy's important too, though.
But Louis Armstrong.
Yes.
Nicknamed Satchmo.
Yes.
Because he had a big mouth.
Yes.
Is not the big.
No.
Well, see how that's very confusing, you would say. To the.
Yeah, but it's not forbidding confusing. It's just fun confusing.
Forbidding confusing. Yeah, I think we're past the forbidding confusing.
No, we don't want that.
We're past that. All right. So, well, real quick before I want to dial into the 70s, which is your area of focus with this project.
Yes.
Okay, so you were saying Louis Armstrong, he started jazz, so to say. Then you said Duke Ellington was the next biggest figure to propel it.
Well, Ellington was an important figure in the sense that it jazz is an improviser's art. Let me take one step back. One of the biggest differences between jazz and a lot of the music that came before it is music that came before it, you would follow what was written on the page, right? You think of classical music, the composer is the king, right? You got your Beethoven, your Brahms, they write it on the page and you do what they say. You don't ever mess with it.
That's what a musician does.
Exactly. One of the things that jazz does is it says, no, okay, what's written on the page is your starting point. But what makes a jazz musician special is that he or she is going to take it and they're going to do it their way. They're going to make it sound different and unique in the way that Duke Ellington or Louis Armstrong or Lester Young or Coleman Hawkins or all of these, you get a list 50 of them, the way that they all take the same song, they're all going to play it different. They're all going to sound a little different. They're going to make variations on it. So that idea of taking it and using a song as a starting off point or a jumping off point for doing your own thing, it really, Armstrong takes that and runs with it and takes what was used to be a collective kind of... a lot of marching band music, a lot of folky kind of music, in New Orleans, and he makes it a soloist art.
Okay, I see.
What Ellington does, on the other hand, is he has a band full of soloists.
I see.
That he works with for a very long time. He has a band that runs continuously from the mid 20s until his death in 1974.
Good Lord.
Some of those people were in the band almost the whole time. Harry Carney, the bass or the baritone sax player, was there from I believe the early 30s or the late 20s until the very end.
Good Lord.
So what he did is he took this band of soloists, and he was the first one who said, let's make an orchestral sound out of all these different people. So I'm not going to write for violins or trumpets. I'm going to write for this specific trumpet player in my band. And he sounds different than that other trumpet player.
I see.
And so you listen to Ellington and you hear Cootie Williams, one of his trumpet players, and it sounds very different than Shorty Baker, who's another trumpet player. And he combines all these sounds. So he's really an arranger and a composer who's taking the sort of jazz approach and applying it to composing. So he's not writing for pen and paper. He's writing for the people who are in his band.
Wow, okay. Wow, yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. So I want to say this as a personal note, and then we'll dial into jazz in the 70s.
Okay.
So... since we started talking, I've been researching jazz, trying to prepare for this talk, and it hit me that I've actually been listening to jazz.
Sure.
And I think maybe other people that might have the similar sort of experience, because like we said, jazz is this thing that's out there, it's like impenetrable, it's hard to understand, but sure. All this time I've been listening to jazz.
Sure.
Which is, for the people out there maybe who like Fish...
Sure.
That it's the jams inside of when they would do their jams, that's jazz.
Absolutely.
And it sometimes they even have sets where they have horns and
absolutely. And or you have bands like Modesky Martin Wood. The whole jam band scene. I mean, when I was a young person in college, there was a huge jam band scene, and Fish was a part of that. They were all to me, they were kind of descendants of bands like the Allman Brothers Band, the Grateful Dead, bands that were rock. They were all rock bands, but they took improvisation, whether it was bluegrass improvisation, you mentioned the other night, in the case of the Dead, or blues improvisation in the case of the Allman Brothers, or Latin improvisation in the case of somebody like Santana.
Okay.
And so they're taking all that stuff, and it might be a rock and roll context, but they're jamming in a way, and they kind of go off into space. Well, that's jazz.
So if it wasn't for jazz, then we wouldn't have this concept of jamming.
Well, yeah, in some ways that is the case. I mean, when you think of a classical musician or a classical soloist, I don't want to go back too far, but for the most part, most classical musicians don't improvise. They don't. Okay. They're memorizing solos, and they play written solos. Whereas a jam band or a jazz musician, they're making it up on the spot. Now, of course, they have licks. They have sort of progressions that they fall back on, but. You know, the best improvisers are, it's really a form of composition that's spontaneous. It's in the moment.
Okay, so I'm getting it. So it was so revolutionary because jazz is the first to make music improvisational, to take it off the page. I mean, you just said that. It's just sinking in.
That's Now, when we say that, we have to be careful because a guy like Johann Sebastian Bach, who, you know, you think of him sitting there at his organ back in the, 1700s? He improvised. And in fact, improvisation used to be part of the world of classical music. Really? Like Mozart improvised.
Really?
Beethoven improvised. But at some point, it kind of stopped.
Really?
Yeah. And it became, you have to do the way that it's written.
Huh.
So I don't know why that happened, but it's...
That's worth a Google right there.
Okay.
Figure that out. Okay, so jazz in the 70s, So that is what your project is about. Can you explain what your project is?
Sure.
And then we'll go into jazz in the 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. I basically what happened is when I first got into jazz in the 80s, there was a lot of talk about sort of a renaissance that was happening, and there was sort of a bit of looking down your nose at jazz in the 70s. It was sort of seen as like a little bit of a sellout time or a commercial time, or a sort of jazz had kind of lost its way time. And, you know, I was a young person at the time, so I was like, oh, okay, I'll focus on, you know, jazz in the 50s and 60s. And that was great. I enjoyed it. But then what happened was I would go to record stores and I'd see records and I would buy records that came from the 70s. And I started like realizing, well, this stuff is great. I love it. I've never heard of these guys, but, and this was before the vinyl resurgence. So you could buy vinyl for, you know, $3-4, practically nothing. And so I'm start buying these records and discovering that I love them. And in fact, there was something there that I didn't hear in any other era. It was sort of very fresh, and I'm generalizing here, but basically it was interesting and exciting. And so, probably 10 years ago or so, on one of the discussion boards that I frequent, I started a thread and I said, the title of the thread was, "Does 70s Jazz Get a Bum Rap?" And it provoked a lot of conversation. And some people came out and said, you know, jazz in the 70s sucked. I hate it. It's awful. You know, it was a lot of electric pianos and sort of... would regurgitate what I'd heard before. But then other people were like, no, man, jazz from the 70s is fantastic, and people are missing the boat. And even though a lot of this music is out of print, and even though these people might not be famous musicians, they're not like Ellington or Armstrong, they're way off the radar, the music is exciting and interesting and wonderful. And so over a period of many years, initially I was going to write a book, but I just didn't have them raising a family and doing my work. I kept listing records that I wanted to talk about, and I built a very extensive list and was keeping detailed notes about all these records. Then at some point I realized, you know, I can't write this book. It's unreasonable, and it's become this sort of unattainable...
White Whale.
Yes, exactly, White Whale, perfect. So what I did is it was coming up on the year 2020, and I realized, you know what, in 2020 it'll be 50 years since the beginning of the 1970s. I had a list of about literally 360 recordings that I wanted to talk about. And in 2020, there'll be 366 days.
It's a leap year.
It's a leap year, so there's an extra day.
I'll be damned.
So I said to myself, why don't I add 6 more recordings, and I will write about a single recording that was made wholly in the 1970s. The record could have been released 5 years ago, or it could have been released during the 70s. But the number one rule is it had to be made during the 70s between January 1st, 1970, and December 31st, 1979. And so that's what I've done. I've now got the list of every single recording for every single day of the year. And my goal is to do it every single day. Now, that might mean some days I write one sentence and say, hey, I really like this, check it out. Right. But my goal is to hopefully just share a little bit about why I think it's special. The other thing that I did that is a little bit interesting, I think, is that I only chose one recording by each artist. So what that forced me to do is, you know, there were some huge artists like Miles Davis, for example, in the 70s, who was making... really important music that was sort of profound music. But I didn't want to spend all my time talking about Miles Davis or talking about the biggest names. I wanted to sort of consciously look in the nooks and crannies and kind of explore the back roads, so to speak. So I said to myself, okay, well, I'm just going to do one for each artist, and that will force me to explore new things. And that's what happened. I ended up discovering, over many years, tons of new music that I never would have found otherwise, because it was sort of like, it was almost like a game. Find something else.
So it's 366 completely different artists.
Well, if I'm a bass player and I play on your record, you're the band leader. The leader is, it's 366 different leaders.
Got you.
So, and then I did one loophole. The one loophole is that if you and I make a record together and we're both band leaders, but we make it together, I can have one as a leader and then one as a co-leader.
Gotcha.
So a duo record, you know, you can have a duo record or, you know, three people get together and they make a record collaboratively. You're allowed to have that as well.
Gotcha.
I have one Dizzy Gillespie record as a leader, and then I have another Dizzy Gillespie record where he collaborated with Count Basie.
Got you. Dizzy Gillespie, Big Cheeks.
Big Cheeks.
Not Satchmo.
Chipmunk Cheeks.
That is not Satchmo.
No.
Okay. So, is this notion that, you said on the message board, you said, does jazz in the 70s get a bum rap? Now, is this sort of, like, this idea that jazz in the 70s is bad, that's sort of just, like, the party line that most people believe?
It used to be. It's changing. You might even say it has changed. Like I said, when I was a younger person, for example, if you, going back a few years in the CD boom and the CD reissue boom, if you would look at an artist, most of the CDs that would be reissued, the classic recordings, would be from the 50s and 60s. Even if the artist recorded into the 70s, they'd always focus on the 50s and 60s. And so a lot of the music that I'm talking about has never been reissued. So it's only available on vinyl. And that's also true of stuff from the 50s and 60s, but I don't know. That era has been held up as sort of a golden era. What I think is starting to finally happen is that especially musicians have caught on to the fact that there was a tremendous amount of stuff happening in the 70s. It was really interesting. And they're incorporating it in. And sort of no-nos, jazz, what people used to call the jazz police. The jazz police will get on you if you use an electric piano or if you play something that feels a little too funky. And now the rules or those sort of no-nos are kind of gone by the wayside.
Got you.
And these are all, you know, kind of impressions. They're not hard and fast rules.
Gotcha. Frank Zappa. We didn't talk about this before. I'm a big Frank Zappa fan.
That doesn't surprise me.
Is he jazz? What is?
He's kind of like one foot in jazz and one foot in like other stuff.
I
mean, Zappa is real interesting because, like, he wrote classical music or totally written out music. Do you know Hot Rats? The album Hot Rats.
Yeah.
That's like his jazzy record.
Okay, so you know, Peaches in Regalia. Yeah, that's, exactly. That's jazz.
That's jazz
ish.
Jazz. Yeah, I mean, again, the whole word jazz. It's just like, remember, it's kind of like a vibe and a feeling. It's not like there's not like you've crossed the river and gone from jazz to not jazz.
Got you.
It's more. Well, I mean, think you mentioned old time and bluegrass. Sometimes the line between those two is really blurry. Old time and bluegrass. You know, the guy that's playing the old time tune suddenly breaks into bluegrass and then he goes back to old time. I think jazz is the same way.
But, okay, so to use the knowledge I've learned in this talk, to ask if Frank Zappa is jazz, Frank Zappa, he was a you know, he was a composer.
Yeah.
He was regimented with, I mean, his band. I don't know how much improvising they did. I think he wrote it all out.
He wrote a lot of it out. I think.
So that's not jazz. I mean, that by definition. That's not jazz,
but he would do the. Didn't Zappa do a lot of guitar?
That's true.
Improvisation, guitar, so, yeah, you know, true, and true. That was. So I wouldn't say like he's a jazz musician, but I would say that he was influenced by jazz musicians.
Gotcha.
And I would say that he could play jazz.
Gotcha.
Okay. Just because somebody improvises doesn't mean they're a jazz musician. You can't say that. Eric Clapton is a blues rock musician, and he improvises sometimes. That doesn't mean he's a jazz musician.
Gotcha.
But Frank Zappa is much more jazz-oriented than Eric Clapton.
Got you.
Does that make sense?
This is becoming more clear.
Yeah.
So, speaking of becoming more clear, let's hit us with some stuff we can impress our friends and family with. What are some things, you know what I mean? Like, we can maybe scoot by, like, even a above-average jazz lover, and we could seem
hip?
Yeah, seem hip, seem in the know.
Wow.
Let's do a hack here. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. So you want some information that you can lay down on somebody. Okay.
And obviously take your time on
I'm this. Trying to I can think of a lot of things, but they're so like the jazz pianist Mal Waldron. He's one of my favorite piano players. Well, to a jazz freak like me, people know Mal Waldron, but most people don't know Mal Waldron, just man on the street. But Mal Waldron, the fun fact about Mal Waldron was that he made the very first recording for a very important jazz label based in Germany called ECM. But he also made the very first recording for another label called Enya. And those and the only reason that happened is because he moved from the United States to Europe.
Wait, he was Enya?
No, not like Enya, like Sail Away.
That's different. Like, whoa, that no, is no, a, no. That is a fun
No, fact. No, this is Jesus. ENJA.
Okay.
Like German.
Well, that's how rumors get started.
But man, that's a hard question. I have a lot of very useless information floating around in my head, but it's hard to know what's going to impress someone else.
Well, I think now that we know at least the basics, Louis Armstrong started it. Duke Ellington was the composer force.
There's some. I would say if you're a beginner in jazz and you want to sort of jump in the pool and splash around a little bit. You want to listen to Armstrong, you want to listen to Ellington, and there's a few other names that I would say.
Yeah, hit us with some names.
I would say Miles Davis. You need to investigate Miles. And Miles was like Picasso. You know how Picasso had these definite periods and he would change.
Right.
That was Miles. Miles in 1970 was incredibly different than Miles in 1955 or 1960 or 1965. But you really can't go wrong. I think Miles Davis was one of the most important artists of the 20th century, full stop. Like Picasso.
Oh, wow.
Like that important. So,
gun to head, we should start with Miles.
Miles Davis.
Gun to head, you got to pick one.
If you want to pick one Miles Davis record, you want to get Kind of Blue. Kind of Blue is...
Oh, that's Miles. Okay.
Yeah,
that's Miles Davis.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The other person that you want to look at, well, two others. So, we got Louis, we got Duke... We got Miles Davis. You got to look at John Coltrane. John Coltrane played with Miles Davis for a relatively short period of time, but Coltrane is another musician that really had a huge impact on the culture at large. And the record that I would look at is either, well, I would look at A Love Supreme. Love Supreme, I think, is what most people consider as his masterpiece, which is a... if Miles was kind of the badass, like, cool, Coltrane was a sort of questing, spiritual, he was a drug addict for a long time, but then went through this sort of spiritual awakening. Kind of had this not at all orthodox or but just sort of a realization that his music is very questing and spiritual and beautiful. And then back in time a little bit, really, well, actually two others, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. And they're really, in the 40s, along with several other people, they were the ones that developed what we call modern jazz, when it went from big band and you had the development of small bands and you had a whole new language. It was a transition from swing to bop or swing to modern jazz, which, you know, Charlie Parker is, when you think of the beginnings of modern jazz, you think of Charlie Parker.
So it goes swing, bop, then modern jazz.
Well, bop and modern jazz are kind of the same thing, but modern is such a loose word.
I see.
You have early jazz, then you have swing, and then you have modern jazz that already is starting to split. You have modern jazz could mean like cool jazz, like West Coast kind of a easygoing vibe, or it can be like bebop, which is more sort of driving fast. And then you have modal jazz, which is when they start using modes, and rather than improvising on chords, you're improvising on modes.
I learned about that.
Yeah.
In my research for this.
There you go. And
something a la Turk. What was that?
Blue Rondo a la Turk.
Yes.
Is it Blue Rondo a la Turk? It's Brubeck.
Brubeck.
Brubeck's another guy that you can... Brubeck is somebody, like you said, you might not even know Dave Brubeck, but you've probably heard Dave Brubeck.
Yeah, for the casual listener out here, that's a good place to start, Dave Brubeck, because I'd known all the songs, and
yes,
I enjoyed them. I did not know that was jazz per se, and that's a pretty important record.
Yes.
That one.
And it was a huge seller. It was a jazz record that people who maybe didn't buy jazz records were able to find a toehold and get an entry into jazz.
Okay. Who's the most famous living jazz musician today?
Probably Sonny Rollins. Sonny Rollins is one of the giants from the 50s, and he's in his 80s now. He's one of a handful of the most important soloists in jazz history, and he's still alive. But as far as someone who's younger and famous, that's a tough question. I mean, there's some... a relatively young person. I don't know how old. Actually, he's probably not that young anymore. Like Pat Metheny is somebody who, when I was young, was someone who was able to sort of make records that someone, again, who maybe isn't like a hardcore jazz fan, would buy his records and he would connect with people.
Pat Metheny. He's still around today.
Yes, and he's probably in his 60s, maybe early 60s now.
Got you. Okay, that's a cool place to start. All right, yeah. Pat Metheny.
And he's a guitarist. So just by virtue of being a guitarist instead of like a sax player or a trumpeter, somebody who grew up with rock and roll, I think it gives him some relatability.
Got you. All right, so as we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts for people with jazz? Well, let me say this before we go. I am really excited, in all seriousness, man, because, like I said, jazz has always been something that's out there. I never even thought to try to penetrate it or learn about it. It just seemed kind of other and out there. But talking with you, going through your blog, I was listening to Alice Coltrane's Ptah El Duad.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just great. I mean, so I really look forward to 2020, and I'm gonna pick different people from your selection and just go from there. That's what I encourage people to do. Just listen, look at Scott's blog and just, because, I mean, it's, how are you going to do it yourself to do all this research?
Or you can get books. I mean, I would love it if people who are listening use the blog as a sort of a gateway or a springboard or jumping off point. That's wonderful. That's exactly what I'm hoping for. But they're books for, you know, beginners. There's the internet is full of resources out, you know, that are out there. But the last thing that I would say, I think the most important thing is anyone who's interested in jazz is don't be intimidated by it. Trust your ears. If it sounds good, then it is good. And I think the most important thing is that don't be upset or be frightened if you don't understand it all at once. I often compare it to reading Shakespeare. You know, I've studied Shakespeare when I was in college, and when you first read Shakespeare, it sounds weird. It doesn't make sense. You know, you're kind of like, it's English, but it's not normal English. It kind of just, and I think jazz is a lot like that. And then suddenly one day, you know, you're reading Shakespeare and it makes perfect sense. And in fact, it's beautiful and gorgeous and you're pulled into it and you're not thinking about, do I understand it? You just understand it.
Right.
And I think that's how you have to think about jazz is just give it a little extra time, kind of just live with it for a while. And it'll sink in one day.
I'm glad we got to that. The aha moment. I can't believe almost forgot that, because that is what you need to enjoy jazz. The aha moment. And I had that same experience with Shakespeare in high school. It clicked for me with Claire Danes, the Leonardo DiCaprio movie.
Sure,
it's like, oh, that's what they mean.
That's exactly right.
So
that's a great point.
You said you got to live with it for a while. So sell people on why they need to put the work in. Because there's some people out there who don't put the work in with their music.
Well, I don't know if I can sell people on it. But the one thing that I would say is that it's just great. It's enjoyable. It's fun. And don't think of it as a puzzle. Well, if you like puzzles, think of it as a puzzle.
Right, but right.
I'm not a particular puzzle fan. But in my own experience, I can think of things, and this happens all the time, even to this day for me, is that when you hear something and you unconsciously, you can't even articulate why, suddenly you understand it. It's really wonderful, and I don't mean understand it in like a logic kind of way. I mean, you maybe enter into what the artist is trying to create or is trying to show you, and you're kind of like, you participate in it. And it's about as enjoyable as anything that I've experienced. And again, just think of like the best movie you've ever seen, or the best conversation you ever had, or the best, any kind of experience that you had that really left a mark on you. I think that's what jazz is. It's no different than those things. It doesn't have to be intimidating or like eating your healthy vegetables. It should not be that. In fact, it should be about fun. And the more you get into it, and the more you learn, the more you're like, oh, that's connected to this, and Louis Armstrong's connected to Dizzy Gillespie, and Dizzy's connected to Miles, and you start making all these connections, and it's fun.
Very good. But I want to tell people, don't be lazy. Fucking listen to it. It's not going to be fun at first. Don't be pussies. Or, I mean, I don't want to be misogynist, but just put some work in. Listen to jazz.
And it will be fun. It will be fun.
Eventually it'll be fun. All right. Well, anything else, Scott?
No, thank you for inviting me to do this. It's been a lot of fun.
Man, thank you.